Welcome back, everyone. It's a pleasure to be able to speak with you. Thank you for joining us. I hope you're doing well today. I'm Henrik, and you are listening to Red Ice Radio. We are independent, a truth-seeking endeavor that is dedicated to informing you about how the globalists, the elite, are seeking to transform the world and us, shaping it in their image by destroying human nature and the natural inherent resistance and rebellion that arise to counteract these life-choking activities. We discuss these aspects and much more from many different angles, the historical view, the conspiracy behind it, but also the esoteric and exoteric application. We are indeed in times of grave danger, but also time of great opportunity. RedIceCreations.com is the website. Dennis Fecho is with us on the program today. He specializes in aerospace, defense, and telecom, but you probably know him best for being the gentleman behind the Illuminatus Observer and the host of Inside the Eye Live. Dennis is an American expatriate living in Amman, Jordan, who brings insights on geopolitics, Zionism, conspiracy history, finance, Middle East politics, and much more. We'll begin to talk about ISIS today, but we have a lot on our plate, discussing organized media as warfare, the situation in Ukraine, Russian nationalism, and the situation in America, and of course the problem with Zionism. Hey, Dennis, welcome back. Nice to speak with you again. How have you been since we last spoke? It's been, almost 3 years ago. Oh my, time goes by quick, doesn't it?
It really has. You know, I think I was on your show to start the 2011 year, believe it or not. And what's interesting about that, Henrik, is when your show came out on, what was it, January 2nd, 2011, I had also recorded a slot in October for A Cult of Personality. And both of you guys launched the interview on January the 2nd, and you should have just seen the numbers on my blog that month, because you had both of you guys launching a pretty big interview on the exact same day to start the new year.
Good stuff. Kicking off in the right direction. Yeah, that's good.
that made for a great first quarter.
All right. No, very good. We have, of course, a lot of different topics to talk about here today. Certainly no shortage of insane games going on at top level to kind of try to deconstruct and figure out what's going on. But I wanted to begin to ask you a little bit about, where you are in the world, considering that you're in the Middle East. How are you feeling about being there right now, considering everything that is going on? As usual, of course, we know that certain things are ramped up in the media. We understand that it's, you know, when they make it seem like it's a war zone, it's actually pretty calm conditions. And it's kind of the reverse in some cases where there actually is real stuff going on. They usually kind of cover it up and try, no, it's all fine. Nothing's happening. But where you're at, how do you feel things is going on right there now at the moment, Dennis?
Yeah, right now I'm in Amman, Jordan, and the political climate is pretty relaxed, to be honest with you. There's not a whole lot of protests going on. We had some protests over the summer about Palestine. But overall, I mean, it's difficult, obviously, for the people, but it's difficult for people really all over the world when you think about it nowadays. So there is some stress within the population politically. I have been going back and forth to Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is just booming right now. The government there has got too many dollars. So they're dumping literally many, many, many tens of billions of dollars into their local economy, trying to get churn on their revenues, you know, on the income streams going. Because to create opportunities for their people. And that's a very smart thing to do. It's unfortunate that our governments are not doing that, and they're wasting our money on, you know, wars, as, you know, as we've seen the last 10, 12 years now. Relative to Iraq, you know, I've been to Iraq a couple times, been to Saddam's house. So I've been into the very areas where now this, they don't call it ISIS, by the way. Locally, they call it Daesh, D-A. Apostrophe A-S-H. So they're using an Arabic term. Local media is either using IS, Islamic State, or Daesh. Just so you know, they are not bastardizing the ISIS name like they're doing in the Western press.
Really interesting. Well, I heard the connection about, of course, it was some woman talking about the, what was it again? The intelligence services of Israel. Ah, wait a minute. No, I'm screwing that one up now. But ISIS was, of course, a hint going back to something that Israel has created nonetheless. Did you hear about that one? Let me pull that up here a second.
Yeah, I think it's still Israel, stupid.
It's amazing, you know. It's I think this was a while back, of course, but okay, well, they might not want to put their own kind of moniker on this so openly, but who knows, right, in terms of what they're thinking about what they can do. But Jordan, you know, obviously close neighbors to Syria. Is there any kind of overlap there in terms of the ISIS situation overall or the No.
See, here's what happened. You know, if you follow military planning, if you follow military upgrades, back in 1997 through 2003, what the United States did is they embarked on a $455 million border control network for the Jordanian government along the Syrian border. Well, that was kind of like laying the groundwork, the defensive groundwork, which would then become the war against Syria. Because they knew that once they launched the war on Syria, you're going to have a weakening of the border environment. You could have extremist elements coming into Jordan. So they created, again, that border zone all the way back, going started in, I think, 1997. I think it finished in 2003, maybe as late as 2005. So the writing was on the wall for an attack on Syria as early as then, 1997, 1998, when they started to build this whole network. So as far as the extremists coming in, this has not been a problem. There was a couple tanks, actually, armored vehicles caught in a little mountain pass up in the north, but that was isolated pretty darn fast. The security network here is very strong, and they took that out immediately. They've been rounding up some people here locally for supporting the various, oh, just call them insurgents or just whatever you want to call them, really. They're invaders by proxy, really. So there's been some of that going on. There's rumors, of course, of training of the various elements up there. So there's trainings purportedly going on. I heard one case where the British Embassy and the U.S. Embassy ordered over 100 buses from a local bus company. Those are being driven out to training areas, ostensibly to train U.S. and British troops, but you have to wonder. What else is going on? There's not been a whole lot, really, to be honest, mm-hmm. as far as coming into Jordan. I think the Syrians would have more of a complaint about Jordan sending people into Syria more than the other way. But we do have close to a million refugees scattered throughout various camps here. That's a big problem, of course, but it's also big business, which I hate to see. But let's be honest, if you're housing 1 million people, that's big business. Who, you know, if you profit 25 cents on a million people a day on a meal, how much money are you making?
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, we even have the same thing in Sweden, for Christ's sake, where all the immigration that we're getting, there's a whole industry there of, housing and clothing the immigrants coming in. So they know about the business aspect of that too, you know?
Yes, it's big business. And those who are behind it understand that business and they position themselves to benefit off of the policies that maybe their compadres across the aisle are putting together for them.
Oh, so, yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Watch which hands are certainly washing the other hand.
Yep, yep. The original ISIS, here it is. I screwed it up earlier, but Israeli Secret Intelligence Service. There was a short video back from the 1990s on C-SPAN, actually, where an analyst was discussing Israeli intelligence, and the Israeli Secret Intelligence Service, ISIS, actually referred to the Mossad. So there you go. Don't know if there's any connection there, but there certainly seems to be indication, of course, that this is very timely. It's perfect. That the ISIS arrived on the stage when they did, and in terms of the intervention that they're seeking to now do in Syria. And I think Israel even shot some planes down here. It was earlier today, I believe, they shot down a Syrian warplane, you know, which they claimed acted in a threatening manner, you know, so.
Heck, if you blink at them wrong, that's a threatening manner. Come on, you know the Israelis.
Yeah, oh yeah.
If you look at them wrong, it's like, why are you threatening me? Excuse me?
Oh, boy. Well, we'll talk a little bit more about some of that later, too, by the way. But let's just kind of we don't have to recap, but let's kind of put things in perspective in terms of what we talked about last time. I mean, you've been doing a lot on the, Kabbalah, the Hermetic Kabbalah, kind of numerology and all that stuff. Where are you at in this research and how has things developed for you in this department, Dennis?
Well, for the most part, the research, you know, I spent from 1996 to 2010, putting all my research down, and then that became the 200 some odd stories or articles up there on the Illuminatus Observer. So, I mean, I still do some research, but the vast majority of the actual formulas, the techniques and the styles, they're already there. They're put down for anybody that would like to come and learn about how the esoteric secret or nature of English works. It's all there for you. The philosophies, the styles, the techniques, everything is there. To put it now, it needs to be, as you know, it needs to be aggregated into a marketable product, really. Because people like that rather than the blog system where you take one story and you can't see where one story is joined to the other when it's really so disjointed as a blog format really is. But still, I do work, you know, trying to just find some various things. Every now and then insights come to me about various words. I can't give you on the top of my head, but things still come to me because it's just part of you after you've done it that long. It's just kind of natural. So not a whole lot of new stuff, but there are things in the works, as you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's for another time and day. But still, the knowledge, what I have, I believe is still one of the more cutting edge Kabbalistic works, Hermetic Kabbalah works on the web today. And to this day, it's my, you know, the numbers are still there. Believe it or not, Henrik, I haven't done anything there for quite some time over at the Illuminatus Observer. But the numbers are pretty much still there. So people still are responding.
Hmm. Yeah, well, that's good. Well, so is there any, you know, kind of reason for why you left it for a little bit? I mean, we kind of talked about this a little bit earlier before we came on here, but there's just so many things going on. There's so many things that are so pressing and urgent in the geopolitical world. And there's so many things that are, you know, threatening everybody's way of life, really. And certain things you kind of just have to, although they're very interesting, they're very, it's just highly, you know, entertaining to a certain extent to really dive into the esoteric and all that. But it's, there's so much important stuff going on, you know, so it almost feels sometimes you have to put some of the other things to the side to kind of focus at what is more imminent and more pressing, because otherwise, you know, if we don't start, you know, speaking up about these things, they will completely run us over, I believe, you know?
Yeah, I agree with that assessment. I think we're really involved in an information war now. There are certain elements on this planet that don't like us. These are elitist style, Illuminati, whatever you want to call it, Anglo-Zionist. I don't care what you want to call them. That's your choice, what you want to call them. I just want the choice to call them what I want to call them equally. But these people, they don't like us. There is an intellectual war out there and information war. And we need to create, quite frankly, the constituency, the political space for elements of light to work. And as we need, you know, especially as you know, since 9/11, all the BS that went down with that, we need to create that political space. Really, it's space for elements of light. I just said that, but it's important. These elements of light that are working in the shadows as well as the other side of the shadows, they need space to work. And the only way that's going to happen is if people like you, like me, and others like us are out there working just as hard as these elements working to control the planet are working. And it's a case where we have to get out there and compete. As long as we have this ability, and the internet gives us that ability, and we need to use the weapons and the tools available to us to just get our side of the story out, create the political constituency. And quite frankly, Henrik, I think it's working. It may not be as fast as we'd like, but you don't need to win over 100% of the people. You really need to win over 12 to 15% of the people.
Mm-hmm.
And that is happening. It's happening in France. It's happening in, like, the Ukraine. You've got a rising vocal voice in America, although America is still very much asleep. It's happening in Spain. You know, it's happening all over the world where people are waking up. And they may not agree with us entirely, but there's lots of overlapping philosophy, lots of overlapping efforts, and every little bit helps. And what I try to tell people, and it's very important, I said, look, a lie needs to be told 1,000 times more than the truth, because the truth, once it reverberates, it can't go away. So we just need to keep telling the truth. We don't need to have the same number of impressions that lies need. We don't need to dominate the media to the degree that it is dominated by the Jewish side of our societies. Let's be honest, they control 93% of our media. So they are a problem since they are not withholding their obligation, which is to act as a responsible fifth column towards the government. They're just hand in hand with the government. Their lies help sell 9/11. Their lies help sell the Iraq war. Their lies are helping sell so much turmoil across this planet. So we have to compete. Again, we don't need to tell. The truth doesn't have to be said as often as the lie. And that's our great benefit, you know, by speaking openly and being truthful and being accurate. That will resonate and reverberate much more powerful than the lie.
Mm. Yeah, it's true. It's something that they have to keep up doing all the time, and it's a hell of an effort. I mean, my God, how much don't they have to do to just keep the lies rolling all the time? And I know that people sometimes they kind of revert back if they keep getting hammered with the lies, as you say. But in most cases, once you kind of opened up that door a little bit, it's like it remains open. I mean, and another thing we talked about too, by the way, is also people's ability to just kind of or that people are in a position of, let's say, holding a lot of information or whatnot, letting people go and kind of, you know, investigating a lot of different topics and you know, letting people get their own time with some of these things and realize that it's you know, it can be a lot of fun to discover knowledge and information and ultimately truth as well, you know. But I think that everyone, given enough time, will come around and see, you know, what's most important and whatnot, because it's way too much bickering and infighting and groupings between, you know, in this particular field, I feel, as well, which is really a disservice. I think that, as you said, focus on the points of agreements primarily where it overlaps, And a concerted effort pulling together, organizing in that capacity to try to, you know, defeat the enemy. Otherwise, I mean, we're going to spend all our time infighting. Nothing is going to get done, and they couldn't be happier because of it. What do you make of everything that's going on with that?
I agree with you. I was just thinking just today, in fact, you know, remember the Bulgaria bus bombings?
Yeah.
Well, what happened was, or let's say the gas attack in Ghouta in Syria. Well, what the media, this Jewish organized media, can do is when they have a particular story they want to sell, they can roll that story out and put it on virtually every single radio and television and cable slot at the same time. Imagine the power that has when it goes out. And this is like shock and awe media warfare, because that's what they're doing. This is shock and awe media warfare using the Kabbalistic techniques that you can learn about through like work like I do. Now, imagine it just goes out, boom, it hits. And yet here you're out, you're doing your thing. We're both kind of, you're professional, you're making money doing what you do. I'm professional. I'm not making so much, but still I'm professional. And there's me, you, and there's many others like us. We don't ever coordinate our storylines. You know what I mean? We don't coordinate to the degree that they do.
Yeah.
This is another, besides what you've mentioned, this is another lacking element. There, in my opinion, to take this, boy, it's kind of turned into a media strategy show here, but to take this alternative media and really make it more powerful, is there needs to be a loose, let's call it a grouping of people, whatever you want to call it there, that agrees to collaborate and launch particular stories at the same time, because then I'm hitting, let's say, 20,000. You're hitting 100, 150,000. This guy over here is hitting 15,000. That guy over there, he's hitting 12,000. Well, you add it all up. Well, guess what? We can hit 500,000 people in 1 week.
Yeah.
But we're not doing that.
I guess certain things, certain things. Topics does kind of, you know, you watch what's going on, you kind of feel the climate out there to a certain degree. But no, I know what you're saying. It's not really that concerted effort in that department, you know, but because this is a warfare tactic, right? Ultimately. So it needs to be a strategy, organization, thought behind this.
Yes, there must, because they're doing it to us.
Yeah.
When they roll out these stories, Henrik, and they're all just BS stories, they're just absolute BS. Like the lies they're telling about the Ukraine right now. Well, there's no concerted effort where we're countering that message. There's individual efforts, and they're doing a great job, but no concerted effort to just kind of like, okay, let's all agree this is like important. Talk about Svoboda. Svoboda is actually, Svoboda, of course, is the far right sector in the Ukraine. The main backer of Svoboda is Kolomoisky. Kolomoisky is the richest Jew in Israel. Okay, how can you call this, quote unquote, yes, they're Nazis, but you think that the richest Jew in Israel is going to support somebody that's not going to ultimately back Israeli interests?
Right, yeah. Yeah, it's quite a remarkable situation and very unique in Ukraine, but I've said that from day one, as soon as I realized what's going on, that they'll use anybody that they can and work with anybody. It doesn't matter if it differs ideologically or whatnot. It's about creating chaos, of course, first of all, but legitimizing the aspect of trying to gain control. And as we've seen with the Nuland situation and the rest of these, you know, hawks down in Ukraine there, they're definitely willing to work with anybody that they can, even if they're ideologically opposed. But yeah, it's very interesting. Ukraine is bizarre, you know.
It's been a fun story to follow, quite frankly. And it's so refreshing to see that Nuland and Pyatt and the CIA and Blackwater and Shea or whatever they want to call themselves nowadays, they got defeated. They had to call for that ceasefire because they were defeated on the battlefield. And that is one of the first defeats that this New World Order type of concept has experienced. There's a stalemate in Syria, but not a defeat. Understand? Mm. But inside Ukraine, they were soundly defeated.
What's going on there now? Have you been watching the latest in terms of the developments? It's just been one of these stories that have been going and going and going, and I've kind of lost track of it, really, in the last few weeks or so. Is there any risk of this, you know, blooming out into a much more severe conflict, do you think, or is this going to settle down at this point?
Well, I think it's going to settle down, and for two reasons. One is that the Ukraine military has been smashed. The right sectors have been pretty well smashed on the battlefield. So they are in very big trouble. The economy, it's moving to winter. You know, we're coming, what, now almost October. Sweden, it can be really cold. And the steppes of Russia can even be colder.
Yeah,
you've got at least the ocean around you to help keep things a little bit warm. The steppes of Russia are an absolute terrible place to be in the middle of winter. So no one wants to be fighting in the middle of winter. These guys, it's their home turf. They know what it's about. So both sides need to pull back because they understand we're approaching winter. We can't be sitting out there in minus 40 degree weather trying to fight each other. It just doesn't make sense. Two is the political situation. There's lots of infighting within Kiev, and there's lots of infighting within Novorossiya. And because of the infighting, there's no real political will to actually go out and relaunch a campaign because there's infight bickering besides in both sides. Both sides have their peace unit, and both sides have their war unit, and neither side on either side is strong enough to actually control the situation. So because of that, they just have to kind of freeze it while they figure out who's going to rise to power and actually control the next step. And that's what we're going to have to wait and see.
Let's zoom out a bit on that in the bigger picture here and the context with Russia, because as we know, we have a lot of the old powers, the old oligarchs, a lot of them had dual citizenship. They, you know, go between Israel and whatever other country they find themselves in at the moment. You know, like Berezovsky and some of these people who, of course, interestingly was taken out, I believe, actually, in London, was it last year? And, because they've been working really hard on trying to control the Ukraine. We had the Orange Revolution, all these Zionists were in there and basically tried to, get control of the situation. Is that what it's still about? That's still the main issue here?
Yes, that's exactly it. This is a Zionist push. It's all part of this, what we call the Anglo-Zionist push to control the world. I mean, these guys are at the very core of it. New World Orderists. They believe in this dominant theory that they have this God-given right to control the world. A unipolar world where only they are in charge, and they're working very hard to make it happen. And the last real place to stand in their way, relative to European Western civilization is the Rus or Russia. Not, I'm not talking about the steppes of Russia. I'm talking about white Russia, the real white Russians, the ones that have always been working for Western enlightenment equally, you know, within their part of this of Europe. And these guys are the ones, I believe, behind the rise of Russian nationalism. And that's, of course, who the neocons want to take out.
Definitely. I mean, I think it's horrible to see Ukrainians and Russians fighting with each other, you know, and I've heard, even talked with some Ukrainians who, you know, were out traveling and they were like, they're insane. They don't know what they're doing. And it feels to me that, and I read about this a while back, but how the media was controlling Ukraine to kind of, you know, kind of heighten this sense of, see, I want people to think about this because this is how they're using it when it fits them. Of course, they were pushing a kind of, you know, a kind of delusional nationalism on the Ukrainians, and primarily the young people got kind of suckered in on this, and they believed that like Russians is the enemy. Let's go around and beat up Russians on the street. That's going to help, you know. It's like horrible to see these two brothers of people, brothers and sisters, really so closely related. They're basically the same people getting in at it with each other, while we have a third party standing, you know, kind of rubbing their hands together, laughing, you know, ha ha ha, there you go, and other people are at each other's throat. And I think it's just, I was mortified when I saw that. These people should get along. They should realize that they're, you know, related, and they should be able to work it out. But no, unfortunately not.
Yeah, I've heard that that the propaganda coming from the Ukraine side is absolutely overbearing and quite frankly effective and just filled with lots of delusions. We should add that, again, Ukraine's media is controlled by Jewish people, so they should not expect that the people in the media care one iota about the Ukrainian people. They don't care. Again, within this idea of Jewish thought and Noahidism and this racist idea, they believe that, you know, all of us goys are supposed to serve them. And if that means dying on behalf of some war for them, hey, it's okay. They don't have a problem with that. And I believe that is exactly what is happening at the spiritual level relative to those who are foisting this media campaign against the Ukrainian people.
Interesting. I want to ask you more about that later, by the way. Noahidist law and, you know, the kind of the religious origin to this, basically. But yeah, what do you think is next here then in this situation? I mean, if they haven't been able to topple it in the way that they have, I guess we're going to see a strengthened response ultimately by Russia as well. They're obviously trying to harden, and they're obviously trying to protect themselves from this, which of course is their right to do to a certain extent. I mean, the people in like Crimea, but other parts of Ukraine as well, are primarily Russian. And to me, it's amazing how much this situation is comparable to the Poland-Germany situation before the Second World War broke out. It's kind of the same scenario here where one is calling the other aggressor, one is trying to protect their people, you know, it's going back and forth. What's the big picture here in terms of escalation and whatnot?
Well, I think now, again, everything's going to stop because of winter. Winter is a very serious thing, both for the Europeans and the people in Russia and Ukraine. I think the big picture now for the next foreseeable 6-7 months is a cessation. You might see some more sanctions from the, again, sanctions just seems to be like so childish. You know what I mean? So childish. We're gonna freeze your money, which, you know, that to me is like a punk kid who's got a ball and now he's not winning. So he's going to take his ball and go home. You know, the laws allowed these Russians to come and invest, and now they want to just take it. That's just theft. You know what I mean? There's no other way to describe it other than theft. We might see more of that. But I think the Russians so far have shown a pretty astute understanding of the politics, and they're playing it well. And I think you might try to see some more divisions inside of Europe, of course, to break it. NATO's going to talk. But I saw Fedorov. He's one of the Duma speakers. And he said, look, NATO's talking about a 10,000-man quick reaction force. He said, do you know how what a 10,000-man reaction force really is? He says, it's a big target that one missile can take out in one day, just a few minutes. Mm-hmm. He said, so we don't care about this stupid force. Then he's talking about what Russia really is, you know, this massive country with massive human capital, lots of untapped resources, world-class theoretical physicists. It's lacking, of course, in the investment that we have in the West in research, R&D facilities, things of that nature. But nonetheless, there's still world-class scientists and mathematicians. Said, look, to us, all of these sanctions are a blessing in disguise because now we can start develop it because it's going to be cheaper now to just do it in-house than to outsource it to the mm-hmm. West.
Interesting. Yeah.
So now Russia says, when we are finished with this, Russia is going to be many times stronger than we were. And when you look at like England always threatening Russia, right?
Yep.
England always threatening. The guy, he's laughing. The guy in the Duma, he's laughing. He says, what does England have? England has a bunch of bankers sitting in London. And we have a massive country. We are the largest producer of oil, one of the largest producers of gas. We have a massive military. We have nuclear weapons. What is England going to do to us, really? What can England do to Russia, really? So we you know, they're basically saying we're not intimidated. Who's Cameron, you know? Who's the UK? This is a nobody. This is a long-lost kingdom that is now wrapped up around the American flag. And yeah, the Americans still have quite a lot. We have a huge offensive military budget, but we'll see. It's fascinating, you know, to deal with these issues.
Yeah, it is. It's definitely a proxy war here that they're fighting, of course, getting other people involved, as it always is, but you know, it's not like other times when the, you know, the oil and gas prices and whatnot have been, you know, low economic warfare in terms of that. In this regard, now when prices are so high, this is obviously something that Russia is really, really benefiting from as well. And another interesting note to that as well, we posted a story about this a while back, and actually they were going to suggest that the Russian media now is to be owned primarily by Russians, right? A revolutionary idea. I think that there were a couple of lawmakers there that prepared a bill to basically order Russian mass media companies to have at least, I mean, it's not 100%, but at least 80% of their stock held by Russian investors. I guess they realize the media war to this. They realize that they're sick of, you know, foreign oligarchs and Zionists with dual citizenships and everything else. And I hope that they manage to, you know, get that in complete control, because that's going to be really important to them as well, I think.
Yeah, there's a huge battle going on inside of Russia right now between the Eurasian integrationists, what they're calling now Eurasian integrationists, and Atlantean or Atlantic integrationists. And the Atlantic integrationists are by and large the fifth column inside of Russia. So the nationalist front inside of Russia is very keenly aware of this problem, and they are predicting a massive purge of the intelligentsia of Russia, if not in the near-term future, in the very short, medium-term future, because they understand the problem. Also, there's one of the former leaders of Novorossiya, Strelkov. He kind of came to fame through taking over in Luhansk and Donetsk. And he's saying the same thing. So we've had two statements from two very high-ranking individuals about a coming purge of the intelligentsia inside of Russia. And the media is just one element of it. They're saying also there must be a purge of the Ministry of Finance. There must be a purge of the Ministry of, as you said, Communications. There must be a there must be these purges because, as you say, and the Russians understand the fifth column there is not working for Russia. It's working on behalf of probably this Noahidist order.
Interesting. Now, I mean, Russia has obviously become a kind of a beacon of hope to a certain extent when it comes to the decadence of the West, a kind of a stable force. I've heard Putin in his many talks talking about how he sees these issues going on in the West, that it's destroyed by intention, by mass immigration, destruction of culture, and ultimately the people as well. And he's been quite outspoken about this. And so I think he sees what's going on. And to a certain extent, I think he realizes that if this continues, what is happening right now, they'll be one of the only countries in the world that actually will remain as a to a certain extent, a homogenous nation. I mean, I know that there's variations there too, but nonetheless, he realized how this game is being played. And I think that that's why all the eyes of the world, it's almost like, you know, Russia is the new Nazis, right? And everyone is turning their eye on them, and they're the big problem in the world, you know?
Yeah. There's this woman, her name is Yelena Mizulina, and she is a State Duma deputy, and she was one of the authors of this quote-unquote anti-gay bill that you've heard a lot about in the Russian Duma. And really, the bill is just saying, look, you cannot create propaganda that targets children, like SpongeBob. It's filled with gay rhetoric. And they're saying, look, you cannot target children as part of your gay agenda. That's what the bill really is all about. And to let you know how strong the Jewish homosexual lobby is in America, they actually put sanctions on this woman. They froze her income, or not her income, but they froze her assets in the West, and they barred her from going into any of the Western states. That's how strong this decadent gay Jewish homosexual lobby really is, that they can actually freeze the assets of a woman just exercising her constitutional rights in her country of where she's born. This is so extrajudicial. It hints of this global law that Jewish people like to think they have the ability to impose on anyone anywhere on the planet.
How are they using this? I mean, something that you'd think be something, a personal preference, what people do in their own bedroom, you know, kind of, it's one of those, yeah, so what kind of situations. But in your view, how are they using this on a political and kind of an ideological battlefront in the culture wars, Dennis?
Well, I think what you see is they're just trying to break down the family unit. Plain and simple. You know, you're targeting kids that are and you guys have been covering this a lot, Henrik, especially Lana over at, I think, Radio 314, transgenderism and creating, turning the boys into girls and the boys growing breasts and things like that. You guys are actually covering this a lot more than I have. So you guys are probably better informed about this than I am. But to me, it's just all about breaking down the dignity of the human race. And it's just turning humanity into this decadent, almost animal stature.
Wow. Yeah, it's really, really disturbing what's going on. I don't know why people can't. Some people can't really see through that, again, how it's being used for political means and how they're trying to kind of, it's a war on human nature, ultimately. We've spoken quite a bit about that on the show as well, but it's really about reforming something. It's like, what is wrong with humanity? Is something wrong with humanity? This is how, you know, the earth has created us, or however you view that, a creator, God, evolution, whatever. We're here now. This is what exists. What is the problem with that? It's all fine. It's been working for such a long time, and now it's like they're trying to deconstruct every aspect of it. And I believe it's for control purposes, ultimately, to take over. With the infertility issue and the chemical issue, those things combined, to take over, you know, reproduction, basically, get control of the population, but also even doing it in such a manner that they can get everyone under kind of a legislation umbrella, that if you no longer have parents in part of this role, but it will be some kind of technological achievement that will ensure the perpetuation of the human species, then we're talking about something completely different. I'm really scared when I'm, thinking about what's going on here and the infertility issue, you know?
Yeah, that's pretty diabolical when you look about creating a technological system where you're procreating via technology and eliminating parents. Now you're creating a precedent that right out of science fiction, I guess, but it can't bode well for the human family.
Nope. It's absolutely not. It's really scary. Now, let's talk a bit more, see if you have anything more to talk about in terms of Putin and strategies, because I know that there's been certain kind of conflicting information as well. I don't know how detailed you are about this, and I've just heard it kind of in passing, really. I haven't had time to really look into the source material for this, but it seems to be that he was doing some kind of work in terms of, he's talking favorably, allegedly, about, you know, multiculturalism in some aspects. He'd been trying to kind of, I guess, appeal more and more to the Jewish community within Russia as well, is, do you think that he's just kind of playing political, you know, ball here? He's trying to figure out what to do in terms of saying something that will temporarily appease people, or is he? I mean, people have speculated about that. It's really still Zionism is really strong in Russia. It's still being controlled. It's being used as this, you know, another kind of setup in the dialectic, you know, political process. What's really going on beneath the surface there, do you think, Dennis?
I believe politics plays a huge role. The Chabad is a huge organizational force across the planet, something like 3,300 institutions across the planet. Very powerful. It has some of the most wealthy individuals on this planet are part of this movement. So it's not something you can easily go after, I guess, or what's the word? See, I lose my language over here, Henrik, being in the Middle East. You know, I really do. I lose my vocabulary. I know what I want to say, but I forgot what I wanted to say. That's terrible.
Yeah, it happens.
You can't minimize them. That's the word. You can't just minimize the Chabad movement. It's huge. And playing politics, Putin, let's be honest, you've been in power for what, 12 years? You have to be a shrewd politician.
Yeah,
you have to be. You can't run another aircraft carrier like the Soviet or Russia, I should say, and not be a shrewd politician. So I would say that for now, based on everything I've seen, I just have to say he's just playing shrewd politics.
Yeah,
he just went after Evtushenko or something like that. This guy was another Jewish guy. An oligarch, you could call him. But imagine, you know, gee, a Jewish guy just happens to control all of the fixed lines of Russia after the fall of the Soviet Union. Go figure. Yeah, no conspiracy here, right?
Yep.
Well, that guy was just arrested last week.
Interesting.
So they're, you know, again, Putin is not, I believe the Nationalist Front inside Russia is a huge movement to be reckoned with. Russian, let's be honest, Putin's riding about 88% popularity right now. It's not like you can say, hey, the people aren't backing him. Yeah, they back him. 88% say the country's, we love Putin. He's doing a great job for us. Probably you see headlines, Putin's finished. How do you tell someone who's at 88% that he's finished?
Right.
You know, the disconnect between Jewish media and reality, sometimes it boggles my mind to the point where it's just insanely absurd. And that's almost crazy to say. But yeah, it's what do you mean he's finished? He's at 88%, guys.
Well, there's been several assassination attempts on him as well. I mean, it's amazing he's still around, really. But do you think that the nationalism in Russia has any capability of teaming up with other nationalist movements in Europe, like in France or, you know, wherever we see a rise of this? I mean, some of them, of course, have responded. I think even the Swedish nationalists, Swedish Democrats have, they wanted to gear up the military again. It's been deconstructed for many years here, but they wanted to gear up again because they were fearing Russia, you know, so they're kind of falling right into that trap to a certain degree. But, you know, hopefully there could be some kind of recognition of unity here in terms of the bigger problem that we have, the elephant in the room, you know.
I don't understand why people at a micro level, you know, are falling for it. Look, the Russians and the Chinese, I swear, they're just out there making money hand over foot right now. They're making money hand over foot. Even with all the sanctions, Russia's economy grew at 5%. Okay, come on. Yeah, it's hurting, but it's still growing. Unemployment is the lowest it's ever been. So, yeah, sanctions are hurting, and it's going to cause some problems with growth. But Russia's not interested in wasting their money on – come on. They're not going to go fight a war in Poland or Austria or Czech Republic. They don't have time for this. They are here to make money and to make things better for their people, which is exactly what our politicians should be doing for us.
Yep, I agree. Yeah, we haven't had a good leadership in so many years. I mean, even a benevolent – dictator, you know, someone who actually has the interests of the people at heart would be, you know, ideal in a situation like this where there needs to be some kind of structure or an order put back into place, because it's just so much of this kind of really corrosive, you know, movements all over the West, basically, that are just kind of eating away at the heart of this thing. And I think, you know, without someone who has the interests of the people at heart and yes, you know, peaceful nationalism, whatever's in any regard, that can work in cooperation peacefully with other interests to realize that this is going on as well, I think would be ideal in this scenario. But it seems at this stage, in a way, there's no hope in sight for that. And we haven't had that in such a long time that I think there's kind of a suspicion overall about any kind of leadership, really, which I guess is healthy at the root of it. But at some degree, it has turned people off so much to it, too, that we can't even envision how a well-oiled, well-run system would look like, you know?
Yeah, I think ZeroHedge.com, they came out with an article, I think, this week or maybe yesterday. Since 2000, the trend has been steady to where now only 23% of Americans believe that the country is actually headed in a good direction. That's what, 71% didn't know. So 23 plus 1 is 24. That means 76% of Americans now believe that the country is headed in the wrong direction and things are not right inside of America. That's huge, you know, and that's a trend that started since 2000. So since 2000, it's actually been a steady trend down. And I can't see that happen. And it's, as you're kind of hinting at, the system itself is failing. When you can pull off a 9/11 and hold nobody responsible, when you can crash the banking system, throw millions of people out of their houses. Now, I know you weren't in America, you're in Sweden, but millions of people lost their homes. The banking situation has caused problems throughout the world, and not one person is held responsible. This tells the people that there's something terribly wrong with the system.
Yep.
And the system must change. And these people are they're not empowered to change it right now, because even the elections, they're rigged. You can't get, you know, you can't vote really because of rigged elections. The system is such that the press works along with the government and the military. And heck, you've seen the stories now about the militarization of the American police. Heck, the American people are virtually facing a paramilitary army now.
Yeah.
If they were to try to protest. So it's a very dangerous time now.
Yeah.
For America and Americans, because honestly, and I'm not an Alex Jones type of guy, but hey, all the mechanisms are in place to just start disappearing people on a major level, and no one would even notice. It's a country of 330 million. You could lose 100,000 people and nobody would notice in that country.
Yeah, yeah. Now, it's this is, of course, a time of kind of great opportunity as things begin to fall apart, too. But it's also a great time of risk, you know, and power consolidation. Consolidation of assets and private property in America, and more of these kind of oligarch forces are also pushing for, you know, more kind of centralized control. You know, as banks kind of fall out of the picture, it ends up in fewer and fewer hands. And there's also risk, you know, where a lot of well-intended good movements, you know, like the Occupy crowd and all this kind of stuff, is like kind of running, potentially might be running things in the wrong direction. And although they might be, you know, well-intended and whatnot, you still have a threat of that kind of globalist internationalism, which is more, in my view, socialist inclined, which is heading in that direction as well. And I think that, you know, America would suffer greatly with the with their population and everything else if it went even further in this direction, with even more, you know, public spending and everything else. I mean, it's already out of control with the military and all that. Yeah, I mean, how do you view that political dynamic there? What do you think would be ideal for, in the case of America, for future direction? Do you believe in like free market and that kind of stuff, or where do you think they need to go?
Well, yeah, of course I believe in free market. I think that all of us need to be able to work at our own way without the government getting in our way. We know what's best for us at the end of the day. Do we, the people, want regulations on certain things like pollution and other things to make our environment better? Of course. I remember the 70s living where, you know, every day, like 280 days a year, was so much smog you could barely breathe. Down in the LA area. So yeah, I still believe there's an effective role for government, but it needs to be downsized. We need to move as rapidly as possible to a peace economy. Peace economies generate wealth for the people at 7 to 10 times that of a war economy. And we've been in a war economy, at least the United States has, for something like almost 20 years now, you know, 14, 15 years, because they started the military buildup 1998, 1999, to prepare for the wars that they knew they were going to launch in 2001, 2002. So free market, yes. Government has a role, of course. Rounding up all the ill-gotten wealth would be great, quite frankly. You know, people don't know, you know, that you hear about the evil Nazis. People don't even know that as late as 1942, Jews owned, that's right, Jews owned upwards of over 60% of the real estate in just inside of Germany. Mm. And that was 1942, at the height of the war. Wow. That just tells you how much, basically, when Weimar came, the Jewish elites used this as an excuse to just basically make Germans surf on their own lands.
Yeah.
And that's what they're doing in America. This same type of element is making Americans serfs on their whole own land. Now, it's more difficult to do, let's say, in France, or, but I think Sweden, it's a challenge now. Not to the degree of America. I mean, come on, America, you got 47, 48 million people surviving on food stamps because there's no jobs.
Yeah.
They need a peace economy. You know, right now they're talking about building a railroad from China to Turkey. High-speed railroad, land bridge. Why? Well, if I'm China and I know that the U.S. has a naval superiority over me that I'm not going to be able to get around anytime soon, well, I'll just kind of like build this land bridge and I don't need to worry about America's Navy anymore. Really, strategically, I don't need. Now I can do my business with Europe and Central Asia. And I don't need even Africa. And I won't even need, because Africa can just shoot it up to Turkey and from Turkey load it onto high-speed trains and move it.
Yeah.
And then they get rid of it. See, America should be investing in this type of technology. We've got world-class still innovation in America.
Sure, yeah.
The problem is we can't get it out of the R&D and into the people's hands. See, America still creates a ton of jobs. The problem is it's outsourced to China.
Yeah, and India and everything else, yeah.
Yes, but think of all those people working at Foxconn, building all these motherboards, et cetera. Well, those are jobs created by America.
Yeah.
So there needs to be some de-offshoring. And the Russians are speaking about this equally. He said, thankfully, all the sanctions are forcing some of the people out there to do the de-offshoring before we actually force them to de-offshore. There needs to be some de-offshoring to force people to not hide their money offshore. Now, they put the FATCA. You've heard about this FATCA, foreign something tax, whatever. It's called FATCA. I don't know what it stands for, but foreign something tax collaboration office or something like that. But basically, as an American citizen, for me to open up a bank account anywhere in the world, I have to declare all my income to the government back in America.
Hmm.
And that bank has the right to actually withhold my income.
Jeez.
But that's how the Americans are trying to do it now. But of course, they're going after us little guys. What are you going to get out of me? $100? $500? Not a whole lot. I don't make a lot of money, guys. I live well. I survive. But I'm not making a lot of money. But they don't want to go after the big, big companies like Cargill and all these other major organizations that are making many tens of billions of dollars and paying nothing in taxes. They won't touch those.
No, of course not. Well, that's the interplay there. You know, as we know, that's how they're, you know, the guise of the free market is using the government to get their way. So it's this perfect marriage there of the elite and how they can use one to benefit and then they can use the other to benefit. And it's the worst of both scenarios, really.
This is a huge problem. All these various major corporations using the government to basically feed themselves. And you know what's funny is they have to, because the system is such that the market is not there, quite frankly, to pay some guy $110,000 to basically do nothing.
Yeah.
And if we don't create enough jobs at $110,000 a year, what's going to happen to your housing market? It's going to crash. What happens when your housing market crashes? Your local government's going to crash because they're taking all their money on property taxes.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you're going to lose. You're going to have all your corporate losses and you're going to have your capital gains losses and on and on and on. It will be this huge imploding bubble. This balloon is just going to just start letting all the air out. And they just can't let that happen, because now everyone will see the total mismanagement of the economy by those in power.
Yeah, it's definitely a house of cards that we're looking at here. But yeah, we're going to take a break here in a little bit, Dennis, and then, of course, continue and talk more. I wanted to get in a little bit more detail on Noah Hiddist Law. You know, he wanted to talk more about some of the Kabad issues that is occurring, and a lot of stuff, that a lot of material you have to discuss there. But let's just talk about where people can go to follow you on a more regular basis, Dennis. You have a great show down there in Jordan. You have a lot of material, of course, on your website and whatnot. I know you're working on a lot of new stuff as well. But yeah, give us some of the website addresses and everything else where people can follow you, Dennis.
Yeah, I have a radio show every Saturday morning. It broadcasts at 10 o'clock a.m. Eastern. That would be like GMT minus 4 or UTC minus 4, I think it is, or 5. I don't know where it's either 4 or 5. Check your local listing. But it's called Inside the Eye Live, and it's known as Intelligent Media for the Politically Aware. We deal with current events, news, mainly Middle East and the Ukraine, kind of like Zionism, anti-Zionism. We talk about the Jewish equation out there. We are reaching, by the way, Henrik, about 21, 22,000 people live now. On the stream. So that's great. We know we're very happy with how that's going. And you can join me over at InsideTheEyeLive.com for that. And then, of course, if you'd like to really know how English works as an esoteric or secret construction, there is the Illuminatus Observer. And Henrik, of course, you've got an old archive. Guys, you can go back and listen to that archive. It's a great interview back January 2nd, 2011. We don't need to redo it. You can just go back and hear that interview.
Yep.
It was a great interview, Henrik. It's still one of your best one in the space, man. It was good, you know. it was. What can we say? It was a great interview and it was well received. And you guys can go listen to it. Again, just go to Red Ice Radio and go to the archives, 2011, January 2nd, and you can just hear that interview about the esoteric secret of English. And those are the two places where I think you can reach me right now.
All right, great. Thank you so much, Dennis. InsideTheEyeLive.com and also IlluminatusObserver.blogspot.com. We'll have both of these links up on the website, so check it out there. All right, Dennis, stay with us. We'll take a short break here. We'll be right back. A lot more to discuss. We'll pick up here soon. We'll be right back. In the next hour, we change topic and discuss what is known as Noahide Law. Dennis will put this in the proper context first from the point of view of his work on the Hermetic Kabbalah, which has been encoded into the English language. He explains how we've had a rich Kabbalistic tradition in the West that was meddled into the Jewish Kabbalah. He tells us about the Osirian and Essesian mystery schools and describe how the two movements in play are found in the Torah. Later then, we'll hear more about Noahide Law, which the American Congress actually passed into law on Education Day many years ago. Well, wait until you hear about the background on this as Dennis elaborates further on how big the Noahide movement really is. Most people have no idea. Later, we discuss the power of vocalizing the truth and creating Kabbalistic spells to reverse their spells. A very interesting second hour is coming up, so don't miss it. Please sign up and tune in at redeyesmembers.com. You can stream or download with your computer. We also have instructions for how to listen in iTunes or your portable device and phone. Also, and I'll keep mentioning this for you guys and gals that are on iPhone or iPad, the new release of iOS 8 are giving us a few issues on the members' website at the moment. We are working on solving this right now, but a quick and easy way to circumvent this is to use a podcast app so that you can download and listen on your iPhone or iPad. We have easy and very helpful instructions in the FAQ on redeyesmembers.com. Just click on iPhone or iPad from there and you have the full instructions right there. We appreciate your patience on this until we've fixed the problem. We have more coming in just a few days, but we'll pick this up right after the break with Dennis Fetcho. Stay tuned for much more. Thank you for listening.